rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Lots in the news today. The House is looking into Bush's record on signing statements. In fact, that's what I want to get into in this first hour here. Keith Olbermann fact checks the president. We'll get to that. More information coming out of the Libby trial. Did Bush out a CIA agent? Was it George W. Bush? Was he the guy? You will recall the once it was out, you know, the message came out that there was a senior administration official who had outed a CIA agent, brought down an entire CIA operation, possibly led to the deaths of people all around the world working for the Central Intelligence Agency, and certainly crippled our ability to gather intelligence, particularly about Iran, George Bush said.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah. He doesn't have any idea. Well, and we will get to that in just a second. And also in the second hour of our program, Peter Pitts is going to be joining us, conservative, who's going to be talking about how wonderful George Bush's health plan is. Absolutely, is absolute paradise. That'll be in the second hour of our program. Just you and me here, the first hour and the third hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, you drop by TomHartman.com. However you spell it, it'll get you there. And just click live chat, it'll drop you in. Before we do anything else, however, I want to just acknowledge Molly Ivins. Molly Ivins, I only met her once. I've been reading her work, though, for most of my life she died yesterday after a long battle with breast cancer. She was 62 years old. And in one of her last columns, it was actually published on January 11th by Creator Syndicate. It was nationally syndicated. I saw it on Common Dreams. Two paragraphs I just want to share with you. She says, the purpose of this old-fashioned newspaper crusade to stop the war is not to make George W. Bush look like the dumbest president ever. People have done dumber things. I mean, what were they thinking when they bought into the Bay of Pigs fiasco? How dumb was the Egypt-Suez War? How massively stupid was the entire war in Vietnam? Even at that, the challenge of this misbegotten adventure is that we simply cannot let it continue. And the we is in all caps. See, Molly Ivins got it about the parade. She wraps up her piece. She says, we are the people who run this country. We are the deciders. And every single day, every single one of us needs to step outside and take some action to help stop this war. Raise hell! Think of something to make the ridiculous look ridiculous. Make our troops know we're for them and trying to get them out of there. Hit the streets to protest Bush's proposed surge. If you can, go to the peace march in Washington on January 27th. And as I said, this was written before that. And I did. She couldn't, tragically. She said, we need people in the streets banging pots and pans and demanding stop it now. So, Molly Ivins, a good life. Thank you for being with us. Thanks for the important work that you did while you were here. And I know that you're in the light now, and wish you well. John Conyers, Congressman John Conyers of Michigan, the new chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, yesterday came out and said, okay, that's it. We're looking into these 1,100 signing statements, or these signing statements that have allowed Bush to bypass 1,100 laws. I mean, the Constitution's pretty straightforward. Congress makes the laws, the executive branch executes the laws, that is, carries them out, and the judiciary makes sure that they're carried out appropriately after 1803, after the Madison versus Marbury decision. As Chief Justice John Marshall added, and the Supreme Court can decide whether or not a law is constitutional. That's not actually in the Constitution, but it has become, standard accepted role of the Supreme Court is to decide whether, in fact, probably the most common. It used to be, you know, in the original envisioning of the Supreme Court, it was simply the court of last appeal. But John Marshall, the conservative cousin of Thomas Jefferson, bitter enemies, he was appointed in his last days, John Adams, as he was being run out of the White House by Jefferson being elected in the Revolution of 1800, one of the last things he did was put Jefferson's cousin and enemy, John Marshall, as head of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And by and large, John Marshall comported himself relatively well. But Jefferson flipped out in 1803 in that Madison versus Marbury case where Marshall said that the Supreme Court had the right to decide whether or not a law was legal. I think in retrospect, Marshall was right and Jefferson was wrong. But nonetheless, the bottom line, Congress makes the laws. The Supreme Court gets to decide whether or not they are within the purview of the Constitution. And the job of the executive branch, the president, and all of his minions, those agencies which Congress created for him to help manage and run, the military, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Education, on and on and on, his job is to make sure that they're done the way Congress requested or required it to be done. And there's nothing in the Constitution that says that the president can say, by the way, I'm changing this law, or by the way, I get to ignore this law. According to Charlie Savage on the staff of the Boston Globe, Bush has used signing statements to challenge 1,149 laws that were contained in 150 bills. These are actually challenge, not just to set up potential future challenges. The American Bar Association last year, this Charlie Savage, the American Bar Association last year sounded an alarm about the escalating use of signing statements. ABA President Karen Mathis testified that, quote, it is contrary to the rule of law and our constitutional system of separation of powers, end quote, for a president to sign a bill and then instruct the executive branch that parts are unconstitutional. Presidents must either veto a bill and give Congress a chance to override their judgments, or they must sign it and obey all of it as written, she said. You know, in 1947, when Congress passed the Taft-Hartley Act, if Harry Truman had been into signing statements, he could have said, well, okay, I'll sign this, except that I'm going to ignore it. And we will still allow unions to be strong in states all across the United States, for example. Or when he tried to propose national health care. Well, that was a negative. That was not something that went through Congress. So anyhow, yesterday, John Conyers says, that's it. We're going to take this thing on. We're going to look into this. And frankly, and of course, Lamar Smith of San Antonio, the Republican representative, he says, this is much ado about nothing. Right. Right. One of the presidential signing statements that I am assuming, I'm actually, frankly, quite sure that John Conyers will be going after, is one that was signed on December 30th of last year. To the McCain anti-torture amendment, John McCain, the Republican John McCain, got passed through the House and the Senate, reconciled in committee, and sent to the White House for signature, an amendment to the Department of Defense Authorization Bill, which said that the U.S. government will not, quote, use cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, end quote. As a result of this, Jane Harman, the congresswoman from California, said the fog of law is finally lifting. America's moral black eye is finally healing. I mean, this is a good thing. This is a marvelous thing. We're not a nation that sanctions torture. So what does Bush do? He attaches a signing statement that says, and I don't think most Americans even know, you know, that this was there. He attaches a signing statement that says, quote, the executive branch shall construe the anti-torture amendment in a manner consistent with the constitutional authority of the president to supervise the unitary executive branch and as commander-in-chief and consistent with the constitutional limitations on the judicial power, which will assist in achieving the shared objective of the Congress and the president of protecting the American people from further terrorist attacks. In other words, he's saying he can do whatever he damn well pleases, A, regardless of what the Congress says, and B, it doesn't even matter what the courts say. Torture? Police state? George Washington had something to say about this. I mean, just the whole issue of police power in the United States, for that matter. I mean, you know, the Tenth Amendment explicitly says the federal government should not have police power. That's we're wandering a little bit of a field, but I would say that this is all part of the same thing. What we're seeing is America drifting into becoming a police state in ways that are, frankly, absolutely inconsistent with the ideals on which this country was founded, or with the ideas of the founders. I'm going to share some thoughts with you about torture and its absolute and utter lack of effectiveness, number one, and what it, how it demeans us all, and what we can do about it right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring, bound by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire.
Actually, I would submit to you that George W. Bush has thrown us all into a major ring of fire here. It's in Iraq. It's a tragedy, and now with these signing statements. And my concern, frankly, is not about George W. Bush. It's about the future of this republic, this nation. You know, where are we going? Back in 1965, one of my favorite authors, Jack Vance, wrote a science fiction novel, a short story actually, called Brain of the Galaxy, in which he writes about a character who's being tortured. And I just want to share with you a fiction and then New York Times reality. Okay, this is Jack Vance from his short story, Brain of the Galaxy. He says, a man's body, which has developed nerves as outposts against danger, seems especially intended for pain and cooperates wonderfully with the craft of the torturer. These characteristics of the body have been studied by the specialists, and other capabilities of the human nervous system have been blundered upon by accident. It has been found that certain programs of pressure, heat, strain, friction, torque, surge, jerk, sonic and visual shock, vermin, stench, and vileness create cumulative effects, whereas a single method used to excess loses its stimulation thereby. All of this lore and cleverness was lavished upon Ergen, who's the character who's being tortured, Ergen's citadel of nerves, and they inflicted upon him the entire gamut of pain, the sharp twinges, the dull, lasting joint aches which groaned by night, the fiery flashes, the assaults of filth and lechery, together with shocks of occasional tenderness when he would be allowed to glimpse the world he had left. Then, back to the room below. The racks tortured by routine, so that the expectation, the approach of the hour, brought with it as much torment as the act itself. And then the heavy, unhurried steps outside the cell, the feeble thrashing around to evade, the harsh laughs when they cornered him and carried him forth, and the harsh laughs when 3 hours later they threw him back sobbing and whimpering to the pile of straw that was his bed. He tried to strangle himself, but a slave watched always. This was not permitted. He tried to die by self-suffocation and would have been glad to succeed, but always he sank into numbness. And as he did, his mind relaxed and his motor nerves took up the mindless business of breathing once more. He ate nothing, but this meant little to the racks as they injected him full of tonics, sustaining drugs, and stimulants, so that he always might be keyed to the height of his awareness. Okay, that's, you know, a science fiction horror story in 1966. We would never have anything like that happen in the United States, right? Deborah Sontag in the New York Times. One spring day, his 3.5 years as an enemy combatant, Jose Padilla, now it's Padilla, experienced a break from the monotony of his solitary confinement in a bare cell in the brig in the Naval Weapons Station in Charleston, South Carolina. That day, Mr. Padilla, a Brooklyn-born Muslim convert whom the Bush administration had accused of plotting a dirty bomb attack and had detained without charges, got to go to the dentist. Today is May 21st, a naval official declared to a camera videotaping the event. Right now we're ready to do a root canal treatment on Jose Padilla, our enemy combatant. Several guards in camouflage and riot gear approached cell number 103. They unlocked a rectangular panel at the bottom of the door, and Mr. Padilla's bare feet slid through and eerily disembodied. As one guard held down a foot with his black boot, the others shackled Mr. Padilla's legs. Next, his hands emerged through another hole to be manacled. Wordlessly, The guards pushing into his cell chained Mr. Padilla's cuffed hands to a metal belt. Briefly, his expressionless eyes met the camera before he lowered his head submissively in expectation of what came next. Noise-blocking headphones over his ears and blacked-out goggles over his eyes. Then the guards, whose faces were hidden behind plastic visors, marched their masked, clanking prisoner down the hall to his root canal. Now lawyers for Mr. Padilla, 36, suggest that he is unfit to stand trial. They argue that he has been so damaged by his interrogations and prolonged isolation that he suffers post-traumatic stress disorder and is unable to assist in his own defense. His interrogations, they say, included hooding, stress positions, assaults, threats of imminent execution, and the administration of, quote, truth serums, end quote. In the brig, he was denied access to counsel for 21 months. Andrew Patel, one of his lawyers, said his isolation was not only severe, but compounded by material and sensory deprivations. In an affidavit filed Friday, he alleged that Mr. Padilla was held alone in a 10-cell wing of the brig. He had little human contact other than with his interrogators, that his cell was electronically monitored, and his meals were passed to him through a slot in the door, that windows were blackened, there was no clock, no calendar, that he slept on a steel platform after his foam mattress was taken away, along with his copy of the Quran, quote, as part of an interrogation plan. In an affidavit, his lawyer said, I was told by members of the brig staff that Mr. Padilla's temperament is so docile and inactive that his behavior is like, quote, a piece of furniture. He lacks the capacity now to assist in his own defense. This man is broken. He's no longer a human. He's no longer with us. His mind has been broken by virtue of a signing statement that George W. Bush attached to a bill. Is this our country? 27 minutes past the hour.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now.
Well, he's definitely not a member of the Bush family or the Cheney family or the Rumsfeld family or the Wolfowitz family or the Furl family or the Fife family or on the, you know, on and on the list goes. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Signing statements. There's a number of things in the news. I think this is so critical what John Conyers is doing. By looking into this power grab by the executive branch, and I don't even think it's George Bush. I think that it is, there is a mentality there that is destructive. It is anti-constitutional. It is anti-small d democratic. It is opposed to the idea of America as a republic. And then, of course, in the Valerie Plame this whole Valerie Plame outing thing yesterday. And why this isn't on the front page of the New York Times, I don't get, because the documents were released in court yesterday. You can actually see them. Jason Leopold wrote about it over at truthout.org. Very good piece, including the government exhibit. In Dick Cheney's own hand, not going to protect our staffer and sacrifice the guy, this prez, and then he scratches out this prez and says that was asked to stick his neck in the meat grinder because of the incompetence of others. So here we have Dick Cheney implicating George W. Bush in the Valerie Plame leak, CIA leak case. Why is this not on the front page of the New York Times? I am baffled. Here's Libby's attorney, Theodore Wells. He lays this thing out. He says, Mr. Libby, you will learn, went to the Vice President of the United States and met. This is testimony in court by Libby's attorney. Went to the Vice President of the United States and met with the Vice President in private. Mr. Libby said to the Vice President, I think the White House is trying to set me up. People in the White House want me to be a scapegoat, said Wells. Well, it's true. And apparently it was this prez. So David Addington, who is the former lawyer for Cheney and now is his chief of staff, they drag him up on the stand and says, and point, give him this memo that I just read to you. And they say, can you make out the words that are crossed out, Mr. Addington? Addington says, it says, the guy, and then it says this prez, and then that is what's scratched through, says Addington. Okay, Wells says, let's start again. Not going to protect one staffer and sacrifice the guy, and then what's scratched through? And Addington's, you know, third time he asks him, attempting to establish that Cheney had originally written that President Bush personally asked Libby to beat back Wilson's criticism. THIS PRES, Addington finally said, spelling out the words, and then it's got a scratch through. So it looks like this prez, Wells asked again. Yes, sir, Addington said. So here we have Dick Cheney asking Scooter Libby to take out Joe Wilson on behalf of this prez. Now, I wonder how many this prezes there may be that Dick Cheney refers to. Now, this, by the way, apparently is the piece of evidence that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who at the time was the lawyer for the White House, was holding back from investigators claiming executive privilege. Addington told this from Jason Leopold's piece. Addington told Wells that when subpoenas were first issued by the Justice Department in the fall of 2003 demanding these documents, he was given Cheney's notes and immediately recognized the importance of what the vice president had written. Addington said he immediately entered into a discussion with Gonzalez and Terry O'Donnell, Cheney's counsel, about the note, but Addington did not say whether it was turned over to investigators in the early days of the probe. I mean, this is the bombshell that Bush was involved in outing a CIA agent, bringing down a CIA counterterrorism operation, and quite probably, leading to the death of Americans or people working for the Central Intelligence Agency.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So we have lawbreaking, and we have signing statements, and then we have the Tenth Amendment. The Tenth Amendment says basically that the federal government cannot have police powers. There are no police powers in the Constitution. There are powers of the Army. And the Tenth Amendment says any rights that we didn't claim for ourselves here, any powers that we didn't claim for ourselves, revert to the states. And the Ninth Amendment to the people, Tenth Amendment to the states. Where to go? Amendment X, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. That's why the Federal Bureau of Investigation is called the Federal Bureau of Investigation, because they did not have the power to arrest when they were created, only investigate. And then they were supposed to turn over the information to local law enforcement authorities who could arrest. This is why there generally are not, or were not, historically have not been federal murder statutes. And yet now we have these police powers being concentrated in the hands of not just the federal government, but the executive branch, and used to take American citizens and put them in prison for 2-3 years at a time without ever charging them with a crime and torturing them to the point where they're broken. And then attaching a signing statement to a piece of legislation from somebody like John McCain saying, we'll torture people if we damn well please. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me back on.
Sure. What's up?
I've been trying to call to encourage people to call the Congressman Conyers' office and just encourage him, give him pats on the back. This is the first salvo in what is going to be a long and, I think, very nasty war with the president. And what's great about the signing statements issue is that there's so much evidence.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily.
It's all laying out there, yeah, for anybody to look at. And you can call. Go ahead.
Well, just with the opening of mail, we don't have any evidence of that yet, but we do have him admitting publicly, you know, that he's wiretapped Americans and so on.
Yep.
So it's a pretty open and shut case. I think people should start to rethink impeachment after this hearing.
Yeah, we have a large mess of high crimes and misdemeanors. From what came out in the Scooter Libby trial yesterday, from what John Conyers is beginning to investigate. Jeff, thank you. 866-220-0044, toll-free for Congress if you want to call your member of Congress. 866-220-0044. Our phone number, 866-440-THOM. And Dale in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dale.
Thanks a lot, Tom, for taking my call. I'm so frustrated. We saw this happen last time with the buildup for the attack on Iraq. It seems to be happening all over again. I've gone to the marches. I've called the congressmen constantly. How can we stop the next war? I'm at wit's end State Park.
I think that we need to be holding our media as accountable as we're holding our politicians this time around. Last time around, our media basically shoved this thing down our throat, and we just sat back and listened. And you know, now I think it's time for us to say no. It's going to be different this time. And for example, this morning, coming into work, I'm listening. I listened to three different networks, three different places on the dial, and heard three different reports about how the administration, people in the Defense Department, the Pentagon, what all, have been watching Iran for a couple of years, and they think that Iran is involved in Iraq. Well, nobody's mentioning the fact that we know that Saudi Arabia is involved in Iraq. Nobody's talking about the fact we know Jordan has agents in Iraq. Nobody's talking about the fact that we're involved in Iraq. Nobody's talking about the fact that Iraq and Iran have a mutual defense treaty. Nobody's talking about the fact that al-Maliki went to Iran and said, we'd like some military assistance here. We'd like some help. Nobody's talking about the fact that there were, these five Iranians taken, and then suddenly five Americans are dead. And what's the deal with this? I mean, it is the media is not being held to account. And I believe, Dale, that we need to begin. Contacting not just our elected representatives, but our media as well, and say, hey, wait a minute, you're not telling the whole story here. I'm sorry, we're paying attention this time. Gwyneth in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Gwyneth.
Hi, good morning. Well, I agree we have to hold the media accountable, but speaking of the media, I would say that the letter that was just presented at Scooter Libby's trial by Dick Cheney is a smoking gun, and of course he's the one who would provide it.
Yep.
And I'd say it's Molly Ivan's parting shot is that smoking gun. And I think you're right. Let's hold the media accountable.
Yeah. Well said. Thank you, Gwyneth. Thank you very much. Chip in Fort Myers, Florida. Hey, Chip. Got about a minute before we got to take a break. What's up?
Hi there, Tom. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the show, that we're all singing to the choir here. I was really moved by Molly Ivan's comments that we are the deciders. Yesterday, I decided to stop listening for a moment, get out of my car, make a placard, and stand on the street corner with 26 other people.
God bless you.
A gentleman that's over 60 years old in a wheelchair, a young 18-year-old senior at the high school who had both her legs broken, was wheeled out by her friends. Last week there were 12, this week there were 26, and over 80% of the cars beep their horns and give a thumb up. So I challenge every single one of your listeners, do what Molly Ivan says. Get a pen. Bang it. Get a placard. Go out on a street corner and make yourself known. These people need to see it and hear it. Thanks.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, Chip.
Bye.
Thanks for your service to your country. That's great. That's absolutely great. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Indeed. We'll be right back.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep.
Now, how can George Bush sleep at night? Not even Bush. I mean, it's as I said, there's this whole bunch of guys, they should have figured out by now that this, you just can't bomb people into submission. It never has worked. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Marilyn in Los Angeles. Hey, Marilyn, what's up?
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you.
I want to talk about activism a little at a more local level, which I'm in Los Angeles. I've actually emailed you about this. I started hearing you at Christmas time, substituting when Al Franken was out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he's leaving the air in a couple of weeks, and I just want to put it out there to other people in Los Angeles to try to get our local station to carry you all the time, because you're brilliant, and you give us ideas about how to do things. It's not just, you know, you're not just beating your gums about things,
well,
but you always have a lot of ideas, and you,
you
know everything, you know.
My understanding is that the Los Angeles is going to be picking up our show. KTPK, or KTLK.
KTLK.
Yeah. San Diego is, New York is. We just heard that Ann Arbor, Michigan is apparently not going to. They're going to replace us with Ed Schultz. But there's others that most of the major markets are all going to be picking up the show. So, but thank you very much for your kind words, and I'll leave it at that, because I don't want to do any more inside radio.
Okay, just, okay.
Yeah, we really should stay on the topic. But Marilyn, thank you for the call. Stuart in Seattle. Hey, Stuart, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, you mentioned that Valerie Plame Wilson, her associates in the CIA, were working on monitoring Iran's potential for the future development of nuclear weapons. I don't remember how you phrased that.
Mm-hmm.
But what you didn't clarify is that one of the reasons that you could suggest that the neocon cabal currently headed by Bush or figureheaded by Bush,
yeah, it's figureheaded,
is wanted to sabotage that CIA program was because maybe they wanted the Iran or other countries there to develop nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, it's really hard to read the minds of these guys, and you get into it and it can get so convoluted. The bottom line is in my opinion, and thank you for your call. The bottom line is that we need to be advancing the idea that America holds to the historic ideals. I mean, you know, that George Washington talked about in his farewell address, his parting address, he talked about avoiding foreign entanglements, you know, that we hold to the ideal of allowing other countries to decide their own fate and future. Yeah, you rescue people when they're in trouble, but that's a whole different thing from what we've done in Iraq, and that this is a disaster that we're just making worse right now by our continuing presence in it. I mean, we're just making it worse. Steve in San Francisco, California. Hey, Steve.
Hey, yeah, I was just thinking of, when I watched George the last time talking on TV, how calm and positive he sounded, as if, you know, he has somebody in his ear telling him that, no, you're on the right track right now. My view is that he's going to get us into Iran, and then everybody will have to shut up, because then the big bombs will be flying again.
Yep. Yeah, well, see, this is my story about rats and corners. You know, it's that George W. Bush is in a corner right now, and if he can have a war in Iran, and if he can use, then he can use that to tell everybody to be quiet. You know, it's time of war.
Yeah.
There will probably be some substantial blowback if we invade Iran, and that blowback may involve attacks inside the United States, and then all of a sudden the dynamic changes. Now you're back to the 9/11 dynamic. Perhaps.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very high stakes game, but I don't think that he has a whole lot to lose right now.
That's why I'm saying it. It's weird how calm he seems.
Yeah.
As if he knows, oh, it's already over. He's got enough maybe backing with the Democrats, some of which are highly placed, that just allows him to have this calmness about him.
Well, he sure has Joe Lieberman on his side. It's spooky. Steve, thanks for the call. Scott in Houston, Texas. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, appreciate your show and everything you do. You're a great patriot, buddy.
Thank you.
Hey, one of your callers said we hadn't had any evidence of them tampering with people's mail yet.
Yeah.
They are doing that. My mother had her mail open. One letter in specific. She's German descent, came over here about 50 years ago. One of her friends, it's also, they're both about 80 years old, was corresponding with her about 6 weeks ago and sent maybe four or five pictures in an envelope with a letter.
From Germany?
Yes, sir. Letter was open on both ends, obviously opened by some kind of machine, not anybody in the post office. It wasn't where it was sealed. And it was basically just delivered to her like that. And I was outraged. I told her, I mean, in no uncertain terms, contract her congressman and all that. She's old school. She's afraid to do anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was outraged. It's this antichrist in the White House. People really need to wake up because this guy.
Well, but see, it's bigger than Bush, Scott. There's a whole chorus out there. There's a whole, you know, when Hitler went marching off to war, he went marching off with most of the Germans. We can't be good Germans. We've got to wake up. We've got to wake up Americans to our core values. You know, Germany, in their defense, they'd only been a democracy for a half a dozen or a dozen years. You know, they didn't have a 200-year history like we do here in the United States of this. We should get this. And frankly, I think we are. I mean, that's the good news, is that Americans are speaking out. The good news is that Keith Olbermann's out there on TV. The good news is that we're here on the radio. The good news is that, you know, God bless her, Molly Ivins is gone, but there's others who are going to step in her place. That Jason Leopold writing over at truthout.org. The good news is that Op-Ed News and Common Dreams and Buzzflash and all these sites are out there and they're doing good jobs and they're doing good work and they're telling the truth. The good news is that people like our caller earlier, I've forgotten his name, I think it was Scott, is standing out on the street corners and saying, enough. That's the good news. 57 minutes past
the hour. You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. George W. Bush has made a number of health care proposals. Health care has been included in, I believe, all but one of his State of the Union addresses. His proposal for health savings accounts. His most recent suggestion about a change in the way that the tax code is handled with regard to health care. And so wanted to get on Peter Pitts. He is the director of the Center for Medicines and the Public Interest. He's a former associate commissioner for external relations at the Food and Drug Administration. The website is CMPI, as in Center for Medicine and the Public Interest, .org. And Peter Pitts, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back. Nice to be here.
Thank you. I take it that you're a supporter of Mr. Bush and his programs.
Well, it depends on the program.
Yeah, okay, well, let's talk about the health care program. I don't get it. Why go through all this convoluted stuff with the tax code to try and solve a health care crisis in this country when we could simply do it with single-payer health care?
Well, I think that the goal here, obviously the president's plan is not perfect, and Governor Romney's plan in Massachusetts isn't perfect, and Governor Schwarzenegger's proposals in California aren't perfect, but I think that they're beginning to hone in on the problem, which is uninsured Americans are costing the public huge amounts of money and are keeping many Americans in worse health than they otherwise could be. And if you can get people insurance coverage, they can get the treatment they need to be healthy, productive members of society.
Well, yes, I'll grant you that uninsured Americans are a problem in that they're postponing health, you know, preventative health care, and thus, you know, things get discovered when they're disasters rather than treatable. But in the United States, if you take the population of this country and divide it by what we spend on health care, you come up with a little over $6,000 a person. If you do the same thing with the population of, for example, Germany, you come up with about $3,000, or about $2,600 per person.
Well, that's not a fair comparison because there's a lot of taxation that goes on in European countries that has to be added into that equation. But the bottom line is...
I'm talking about total payments for health services. I'm not talking about where the money's coming from, just it costs to deliver health care. And so I would submit to you, Peter Pitts, that it is not the uninsured in America who are the problem, as you suggested. It is that we have a giant leech on the back of our health care system in this country called the health insurance industry that is sucking hundreds of billions of dollars out and putting it in the pockets of CEOs like William McGuire, who took $1.78 billion in paychecks and compensation. I mean, this is money that should be healing people.
Well, you get no argument from me. I think that we need insurance reform that requires the insurance business to behave more fairly and cover more people more equitably.
How about the insurance business ceases to exist?
Well, I think that you have to replace it with something. Clearly, you know, we've built our coverage system on the insurance industry, and part of the problem is that the way the insurance industry is regulated, you can't buy a policy in New Hampshire, and then when you move to Montana or California, use the same policy. You have to go through the whole rigmarole again, and it's full of loopholes and pork and, you know, special interest.
Well, plus it's the only industry outside of Major League Baseball that's exempt from antitrust regulation.
Yeah, that's a real problem, and I think you've got to get at it. And any way you can get at it is a good thing. And I think all of these plans begin to address the fact that the insurance industry has to step up to the plate and accept responsibility for part of the problems that it's caused.
Why don't we, the people, simply say to the insurance industry, thanks but no thanks. We're going to go with Medicare for all. Let all Americans sign up for Medicare. In Canada, you pay about $40 per person monthly fee. It's a sliding scale depending on your income, of course, to participate in the equivalent of a Medicare for all program. And, you know, there may be some people who would want to opt out. They'd want to have the equivalent of, you know, a Canyon Ranch kind of place that they can go to, their own private health resorts or, you know, their own private doctors. And presumably there's a role to play for private health insurance companies at that, you know, super elite high-end market. But outside of that, sorry, we have a program in this country. It works just fine. Let's just make it universal.
Well, I think, I'm surprised, Tom, to hear you say that the Medicare system works just perfectly. I'll have to remind you that next time we talk. But I think that when it comes down to it, you want to give people as many choices as they want. And right now, the way the insurance industry in this country is constructed, people don't have as wide a variety of choices.
People don't want choices, Peter. People want health care.
That's right. People want health care, and they get that health care through the options that are made available to them through various ways.
If my back is hurting, I don't want to know that I have 9 health insurance companies I can call or 26 doctors I can call. I want to get my back fixed.
Well, I think at the end of the day, when you talk to people absolutely do want choices. They want to get the right doctor, and they want to go to the right hospital, and they want to get the right medicine. And I think private insurance plays a large role in that. It's done a pretty good job. It needs to do a whole lot better job, and especially now when we're having an aging population that's dealing with acute problems that could have been solved way earlier on in the proposition.
So you really believe that the average American thinks that they know so much about medicine that they should be making choices about how they're going to be treated? That if somebody is going to, you know, if somebody breaks their leg, they should call 5 different doctors and say, do you know how to do little metal pins, or do you use the little plastic ones and stuff like that?
I think the average American wants to have the opportunity to call their own doctor and have that doctor give them the option about what should be done. I'm not talking about self-prescribing. I think that when you look at, for example, the Medicare Part D program, like with many, many choices, hundreds of choices across the country, senior citizens voted with their feet and said, yeah, they absolutely did want the choice.
You're saying that because people signed up for Medicare Part D, which is where you have all these different private health insurance companies that are offering, and some actually even to fill the donut hole, but through whom the government, our tax dollars are routed and then into the pockets of the pharmaceutical companies, because people signed up for them, they were endorsing them?
Well, I think if you ask people, who do you want to make the choices for you, yourself or the government, I think you get a pretty resounding answer there, and it wouldn't be Uncle Sam.
Well, what if the question is, who do you want to make the choice for you, yourself, your government, or a for-profit corporation that's only interest is the bottom line, and they don't give a damn about your health?
Well, I think that's right. That's exactly, I mean, we're in agreement that the insurance industry is in major need of retrofitting so that people, when they make a choice, have a fair choice and aren't being taken advantage of. You know, simply saying that, we don't need private insurance and that, a panacea solution is to let the government provide health care for all is just replacing one big problem with another big problem.
But it's working quite well in 36 out of 37 industrialized nations right now.
Well, I think if you look at these countries, I certainly question that. I think that you have a lot of people coming to this country for health care. You have a lot of people.
Very few. And you have a huge number of Americans leaving the United States for health care. You've got a health care tourism business going to Thailand and India right now.
Well, I'd like to hear from your listeners whether they think that they're ready to go to Thailand or India for insurance reasons or for operations. And I disagree that a lot of people aren't coming here for care. A lot of people are crossing the border from Canada every day for care, for diagnostics.
You know, Peter, I lived for 10 years in Vermont, an hour and a half from the Canadian border in Montpelier, Vermont. And I never once, and one of my very best friends is a physician there, who's a member of the Physicians for National Health Care Program, PNHP, I think it's called, National Health Program. And Deb never once, she'd never seen a Canadian. But every week in Montpelier, the bus would line up and senior citizens would get on to go up to Canada to buy pharmaceuticals. I mean, I never saw Canadians coming.
Well, like you said, you live in Montpelier. I lived in Montreal, and I knew a lot of people going south for care.
For cosmetic surgery?
For MRI machines, for surgery, for knee replacements, for a whole bunch of things. And the fact of the matter is, if you go to the movies and see a movie called The Barbarian Invasion, it actually gives a very good example of why that happens. You know, people, go different places to get what they need, and that's exactly what a capitalist system provides, the opportunity to make a choice. So,
But isn't healthcare, shouldn't we consider healthcare part of the commons? I mean, isn't healthcare a right and not a privilege? Shouldn't it be something that we are collectively providing for us? And around the fringes of it, if somebody wants a boob job or something like that, or they want to get their lips enhanced, let that be a part of a for-profit part of the industry. But if somebody's sick, shouldn't that be something that we collectively attend to?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think if you take the Medicare, the Medicaid population out of the equation and you look at the folks that don't have insurance, these are people that are making the choice not to and to be able to get insurance from their own pocket or subsidized if required. But that doesn't mean that the insurance industry as it's designed right now in the U.S. is fair and equitable. I agree with you. I think it's not.
But if healthcare is a right and not a privilege, then it should be something that we administer or that we offer to ourselves through this thing that we call the government. It's we the people.
Well, we live in a free market system, and I don't think that whether it's a right or a privilege or both, that the government is the best provider or the provider that's going to provide the best opportunity or the best quality.
Well, first of all, I'm not suggesting the government should provide health care. I'm suggesting they should pay for it. That actually we should pay for it collectively, that the government should be the insurance company, because they're not going to be taking profits off the top. They're not going to be paying a CEO, $1.78 billion a year.
Well, I think that's not necessarily, the truth. I think everybody that ends up writing the check becomes the CEO of the operation.
Okay, interesting. Peter Pitts, he's the director of the Center for Medicines in the Public Interest, former Associate Commissioner for External Relations at the Food and Drug Administration, CMPI.org. Thanks, Peter, for coming on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program. Is healthcare a right or a privilege? We really need to have that discussion in this country. We'll be right back.
We're privatizing Medicare, it's history, and what will take its place will be a prime example, truly ample, opportunity. Oh, there's a hefty deductible on all the drugs you need. And there's co-payments for sure, we're selling a cure. If you didn't agree, oh grandma, sign the paper, grandpa. Don't be slow, yes, you'll get medication if you join our HMO.
Yes. No. Oh, grandma, sign up. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, listening for your local sponsors and patronizing them, letting them know that you're listening, and our national sponsors as well. I mean, this is one of the areas here. This is commercial radio. I don't want the government running radio. I don't want the government running Sacred Grounds Coffee. They sacredgroundscoffee.com. They do a great job. Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com. Eco Wine, the organic wine company, ecowine.com. Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW. These are private corporations, and God bless them. They're all doing a great job. But with something that has to do with a fundamental ability to survive, health care, in my opinion, it should be considered a right. And once it's considered a right, it is part of the commons. And once it is part of the commons, it is administered by we the people collectively. And, that's just the beginning and end of it all. It's been a while since we did a barrel, and we'll take your calls on this at 866-440-8466 or any other topic you want in just a minute. It's been a while, however, since we've had an opportunity to have one of our Berlusconi alerts. You remember Silvio Berlusconi, the guy who bought up radio, the small-time crook in Italy, right? Small businessman and sort of mafioso wannabe. And he buys a radio station, and then he buys a TV station, and then he buys another radio station, and then he buys a newspaper, and then he buys another radio station, then he buys another TV station, then he buys a radio network, and then he buys a TV network, and then he buys another radio network, and then he buys another TV network, and then he buys a couple more newspapers, and pretty soon he owns all the radio networks and all the television networks in Italy and half the newspapers, and then, surprise, surprise, he runs for prime minister. And guess what? He won for a while. 6 years. He just got defeated, actually, this last year. Finally, the long national nightmare of Silvio Berlusconi was over. Well, he's in the news today, so we have an opportunity for a Berlusconi alert. Yes, indeed. This from the New York Times by Ian Fisher. Dear editor, began a letter published Wednesday on the front page of La Repubblica, the newspaper that Silvio Berlusconi hates the most. The scalding letter demanded an apology from Mr. Berlusconi for flirting publicly, and it was signed by his wife! And so, a nation bored and a little down at its return to semi-normal politics woke to a juicy news cycle with an inescapable conclusion. In or out of power, Mr. Berlusconi may behave reprehensibly, but Italy cannot keep its eyes off him. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. Always nice to have Silvio to kick around. And also a good reminder to us of the very real consequences of media consolidation. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Bob in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I just want to reinforce your point here about market, the so-called free market controlling our healthcare system. One of the problems that you have with healthcare, and if you study economics, with most commodities where the free market will work efficiently is where you have substitutes.
Yeah, you have alternatives. And if you've got a broken leg, you know, you can't say, well, you know, I think I'll go get my arm treated instead or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. So if the price of coffee goes up, you can drink tea.
Right.
With healthcare, I guess the substitute is not having healthcare.
It's so dying.
You die. So I guess that's traditionally is where, like you say, the commons like water there's no substitutes for water. Electricity is something else. So that's traditionally where we've allowed a natural monopoly to exist. And
yes.
So
yes. Absolutely, Bob. Spot on. And I feel the same way, frankly, about power systems, by the way. Electricity. There's only one set of wires coming in my house, but that's a whole other rant. But the natural monopoly, perfect analogy. Karen in Alameda? Alameda, California. Hey, Karen, we have to take a break in about a half a minute. What's up?
Well, I just was going to say, as far as health care right now, I think choice is just a Republican buzzword. We choose, our employees choose the HMOs that we could pick.
Mm-hmm.
We pick our doctor, and after that, our choice ends. We have to go to the hospital that our doctor chooses. We have to go to the specialist that the doctor works with. I'm scheduled for surgery. I have a choice of one doctor.
Yeah.
I think it's just like school choice, medical choice, Republican talking points.
You know, it's amazing when when they were running the Harry and Louise ads against Hillary Clinton's plan, you know, way back in the day.
Yes. Uh-huh.
They said, do you want the government deciding for you or not? And really, they should have been saying, do you want the government deciding for you or do you want some big corporation? Because within a year of the time that they stopped running those ads, all of a sudden the big corporation started deciding which doctors you could go
that's
to.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly how it happened. Karen, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
Anybody here see the noise, see the fear and commotion? I think we missed it. Anybody here see the love, see the hate, be in motion?
And welcome back to the vast radical metal conspiracy. The vast liberal conspiracy, the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Just very quickly, Keith Olbermann last night on Countdown did a marvelous job of compiling some sound clips from George W. Bush. 2002, when he was talking about, gee, wouldn't it be nice to invade Iraq? And now, 2007. Here we are. Just for comparison purposes. Here, 2002, George W. Bush.
The Iraqi people cannot flourish under a dictator that oppresses them, threatens them.
That was 2002, now 2007.
Our struggle is not with the Iranian people. As a matter of fact, we want them to flourish.
2002, Bush said.
Iraq is a land rich in culture, resources, and talent.
And in 2007, Bush said.
And the Iranian people are proud people. They've got a great history and a great tradition.
And in 2002, Bush said.
The people of Iraq will continue to live in brutal submission. The region will remain unstable with little hope of freedom.
And in 2007, Bush said.
And one of the things that the Iranian government has done is they've begun to isolate their nation to the harm of the Iranian people.
Seeing a pattern here? 2002.
Hopefully this can be done peacefully.
And now 2007.
I believe we can solve our problems peacefully.
And back to 2002.
All options are on the table.
And in 2007, Mr. Bush says.
All options are on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tip of the hat to Mr. Oberman for compiling that collection, and thank you very much. And for pointing it out to us all. And Gary, New York City. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I have a comment I'd like to make about your show and then a question for you.
Sure.
Do you think that your time would be better spent interviewing people that back what you're trying to say instead of trying to turn around some of these knuckleheads that you get on sometimes? I mean, I appreciate the mind exercise that you go through, but you know, these people are being paid to do a job. I mean, for that, like, I hear a lot of times you talk to people, if for them to admit that you're right would basically be them going back and submitting their resignation.
No, I understand that, Gary. And there's a first of all, I do have people on with whom I agree. For example, in the next hour, we're going to have Larry Johnson on, talking about the Iran-Iraq situation. But I think, first of all, it's really important that people have a model for how to have the debate. There are so many of us out there who have conservatives in our lives. I mean, you know, my father this summer died a Republican, with a picture of George Bush on the wall as he was dying. People at work have, you know, friends who are Republicans, the family, whatever.
If I might say something, you know, I go on the internet and go to some blogs that aren't necessarily political, but they have aspects of them that are like off topic aspects. And I talk to some of these people, I can't imagine what, like, I like to call people, you know, I don't know, 15 percenters or whatever. But there are some people out there that no matter what the facts are, like...
No, I get that, Gary. I absolutely get that. And they're the perfect people for me to debate on the air to help people learn how to win the water cooler wars, because the people who are your friends and your family are not going to be as unreasonable as these guys. So if I can have the debate with them at the most extreme level,
yeah,
and still have it be a rational debate and still get the points out and model for people how to win the water cooler wars, then it's that much easier for them with somebody who's just a friend or a family.
Absolutely. Can I get to my question?
Sure.
Okay. One of the things that I fear is that it looks like the Bush administration and Cheney, basically, are setting us up now for this Iraq or the Iran attack. They're sending another battle group in there. Okay, now, what are the mechanics of the government that would keep them, let's just say they attack with a limited airstrike from a couple of carriers, okay, and the world response is something they can't control. Let's say, you know, I heard Mike Malloy last night, you know, talking about how, you know, Venezuela could possibly stop shipping oil to us. Oil prices would go up. There'd be, you know, a massive response.
Sure.
Now, what would stop Bush from then declaring martial law and saying, you know what, the OA election is out, we can't do anything about it, because, you know, you can't have an election in the middle of it.
Legally, nothing would stop him because of the executive orders that were signed by Richard Nixon.
Do you think that's possible?
No. And the reason why is because I don't think that we the people would stop him. I think that there...
You know, these people don't listen when going on a march. They don't care. I mean, his foreign policy is proven, you know, to foreign leaders.
Congress is waking up, Gary. Look at what happened in the last elections. Look what's happening. Yeah, it really is. I mean, yes, the process is slow. It's like, you know, it's kind of gross. It's like watching sausage be made. But the fact of the matter is that the American people are waking up. Congress is waking up. This country, we are taking this country back. There is no doubt about it. These guys are on the decline, not the incline.
If he attacked Iran, let's just say he could do that without Congress or whatever. Let's just say he did that and started those dominoes falling.
Yeah.
Okay. What, you know, there's going to be a lot of these idiots that are just going, well, you know what? Just like after this Iraq thing, you know, come up with a plan, you know.
Gary, I understand, and it may happen, and it may put us through hell. It may absolutely put us through hell, but I also believe that this country will come back from it. We went through a civil war. I mean, we went through World War I, we went through World War II, we went through the Great Depression. We have a 230 some odd year history of democracy in this country. Yes, we haven't always played it out perfectly, but it's getting better and better all the time, even with this little 6 year regression that we've had. And I am absolutely confident that even if we have, a major disaster, like Bush declaring war with Iran, and even if the Soviets and the Chinese get involved, which I'm really concerned about.
Who would have thought that the American people would sit down and just watch what happened with Katrina in the Gulf Coast? I mean,
I don't think they have. I think the American people are genuinely angry about that. They're genuinely freaked out about it, and they want a government that works. And I think
Bush generally doesn't care.
And Bush is on his way out. Gary, I got to move along, but I appreciate your call. I appreciate your passion, and you know, keep spreading the good message out there. It's good to hear from you. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim.
Tom, in Allegheny County here, you're talking about knocking off like 400 transit drivers.
Yeah.
And that comes down to about 60% of the routes that they're doing. And what the county executive had to say about it, he says, we give $25 million, we can't afford no more. But what happened here, Tom, years ago, none of the outland bus districts could handle it and make a profit. So the government formed a port authority.
Sure.
And they have to realize that they have to operate losing money.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Transportation is also, in my opinion, part of the commons. We actually subsidize cars. I mean, we pay for roads, we pay for street signs, we pay for traffic enforcement, we pay for all that stuff. And if we were to transfer some of that money into things like light rail and bus systems and public transportation systems, it would be a very, 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 very good investment. In fact, in communities where you have those kind of investments made, you get a real substantial return on investment. It's absolute. There is an absolute return on it. I think it's for every dollar invested in light rail, you get $9 back over the course of the next 10 years for the system. Steve in Franklin, Tennessee. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Man, I'd just like to start off by saying your book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, changed my life and others that I've turned it on to. And I think everybody should read that book.
Thank you.
Anyway, off topic. I just want to comment on your conversation you had a few minutes ago with the guy about healthcare, talking, universal versus private.
Yeah.
I'm a Canadian citizen. I've been living in the U.S., for quite a number of years now, so I've seen, both sides of it, and still, talking to my parents who live up there. There's really, it's kind of a pain both ways, with the universal, with the private. You got a lot of the same situations that you're dealing with on both sides. Long waits, not enough beds. I've had to deal with that here and there. I think the big issue in the U.S. that lies is between having your government healthcare plans. Like I was on 10-care for a while with my wife because I wasn't employed full time. I couldn't get full time benefits, and just the way that you're treated when you're at the doctor's or in the hospital with a government plan, as opposed to, oh, okay, he's got insurance through his job. It's like the big difference in the way you're treated.
We have a two tier system here. We have a good system for folks with health insurance and a moderate to poor system for folks with Medicare, Medicaid, and variations thereof, and then a tragic system for people with no insurance at all.
Yeah. But I tell you what, I would much rather have it available to me, as my folks do, and deal with the hassles.
You'd prefer the Canadian system.
Yes. Yeah. Much rather.
Okay. Steve, thanks for the vote. Thanks for letting us.
Keep up the good work, Tom.
And you too. Tag, you're it, Alan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thanks, Steve. Alan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Tom. I had probably the man that was just on probably could answer the question maybe better than anyone. But my question was, the man that you did have on, your guest, said that people from Canada come down to get, you know, hip replacements, knee replacements, MRIs. Are these people, when they come into America, to have this done, are there, is their Canadian health plan paying for them to come to America?
No, no,
or
this would be,
Canadians,
that's right.
They don't even have to have insurance. A wealthy American wouldn't need insurance either. I mean, the upper 10% or whatever could pay for anything catastrophic that could possibly happen to them.
Yeah.
Or the bottom can't, or the middle class that can't, because,
yeah,
like you said, I think it was like $40 a person in Canada. Well, I know it. I'm paying much more than that here.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, Alan, and that's the point, is that it's really about the most of us, not Bill Gates he doesn't even need a health insurance policy, right? He can write a check for whatever he needs. And there's a lot of wealthy Canadians, they want cosmetic surgery, they come here quickly, 45 minutes past the hour.
And just because he said that there was weapons hidden under pig skies over there, just because my boy may never make it home again, don't mean he don't care.
I can't sing, I'm sorry. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us, an accredited White House reporter. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, I just came away from the White House press briefing, and I asked Tony Snow a question about something that's gone pretty much unreported, that Dana Perino, who's an assistant White House press secretary, one of the nicest people I know, said yesterday. She said, these resolutions send mixed signals to our troops and our enemy. So I was asking him, should we really be concerned that the exercise of our responsibilities as government is misunderstood by the enemy so much so that we don't pass resolutions?
Right. And in other words, being a democracy is misunderstood as, what was Tony Snow's response?
Well, he said that they should think about it very carefully.
Wow. Wow. You know, Nikita Khrushchev, When I was working in Russia back in the late 80s, there was a story that was told to me by a Russian. This was in Kaliningrad, and I've since heard of variations on it from other people. It's probably one of those kind of apocryphal stories. Everybody seems to know in Russia about Khrushchev was in the Politburo when Stalin was the leader of Russia,
mm-hmm.
and never objected to Stalin. And Stalin dies, and Khrushchev takes over. And Khrushchev is up given, and it became very fashionable in the first year after Stalin died, to denounce Stalin. And so Khrushchev is up at the podium in front of the whole Politburo, and he's denouncing Stalin. And he's talking, Stalin was a son of a, this is what, we're going to do better. And somebody in the back yells out, where were you when Stalin was up there? Why weren't you speaking up? Khrushchev looks around and he goes, who said that? And there was just this absolute silence.
I bet that was.
And then he looks a little harder and he raises his voice a little louder and he says, who said that? And nobody's even breathing now. And finally he pounds his fist on the podium and says, who said that? And just total silence. And then he cracks a little smile and he says, sir, where you are sitting now is where I was sitting when Stalin was here. Get the story?
Yeah.
So that seems to be the message that Tony Snow and the Bush administration are trying to convey. How dare you defy us? How dare you speak out against us?
And they would say that that's not the case.
Yeah.
They would say that they merely want people to consider their actions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what Khrushchev was saying to the guys in the Politburo. consider your actions. So I'm curious, Victoria Jones, why isn't the press going nuts, or maybe they have in the last 3 hours that I've been on the air here, and although I've been keeping track of the wire services and the NYTimes.com and whatnot, why isn't the press going nuts about the fact that in the Scooter Libby trial yesterday, we discovered that that smoking gun memo that Dick Cheney wrote, basically ordering the outing of Valerie Plame and the destruction of a CIA counterterrorism operation, had the phrase "this prez" in it, and Cheney scratched it out, but originally he was saying basically, do this on behalf of this president.
Yes, it does have this prez, although it's not clear what he was going to write after it, because, of course, we don't know once he changed that and inserted, I think it's the guy, and then gone on.
So it may be that he meant to say he was thinking about writing this present of red roses I'm going to give to Scooter.
Precisely. That may be what he was intending.
But why isn't the press raising the issue? Is this the smoking gun that implicates George W. Bush in bringing down a CIA operation?
I think it's a whiff of a gun. I think as much of a gun as anything else really is the whole thing. Is the fact that I raised this days ago, the fact that, okay, if you're sacrificing one to save another and you've got Cheney on your side, then you've got somebody on the other side. And who is high enough up on the other side? There's only one person high enough up on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. And that's Bush.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and at the same time, you got Bush running around going,
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
How could he say that when he knew that it was Cheney? Apparently, the scheme was hatched in a meeting with him and Cheney and Rove and Libby.
Yeah, he was apparently able to say that.
Yeah, amazing.
I mean,
okay.
John
Conyers has begun investigating signing statements. How's that going?
They had their first day yesterday, and this looks like being a pretty lengthy investigation. Who knows how far they can get with this, obviously, because the president intends to continue doing it, and short of taking the pen out of his hand, I don't see how they can stop him. But they intend to get as much ammunition, legal ammunition, as they possibly can to say that legally, constitutionally, he simply cannot do this.
Well, couldn't they simply pass a law saying presidential signing statements are not considered law?
Well, I don't know whether you can do that constitutionally.
And then Bush would attach a signing statement to it saying yeah, except for...
Exactly.
So ultimately, what we have here is what's referred to as a constitutional crisis. It's something that's going to have to go to the Supreme Court.
It will have to go to the Supreme Court, and we've no idea which way they're going to jump on this.
Right, but now there's not yet a case that will take it to the Supreme Court.
No, there has to be a case.
Yeah, interesting, very interesting. Well, we'll see how it shakes out. Victoria Jones, thanks for the report from Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
Always great to hear from you. TalkRadioNews.com. We'll be back with Larry Johnson after the news at the top of the hour. What's going on with Iran and Iraq? The British newspapers are talking about February 24 as the strike date. And then, of course, we'll also be taking your calls throughout the next hour at 1-866-440-THOM. You feel free to drop by our live chat room, TomHartmann.com, and hang out with some of the finest minds, sometimes some of the wackiest, but by and large, some of the finest minds in the entire Internet, maybe the entire universe. Who knows? We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Tom Hartmann here with you. Larry Johnson, a former Central Intelligence Agency, U.S. State Department officer, Department of Counterterrorism, an expert in the fields of terrorism, aviation security, crisis and risk management, now an independent in that field. If you're looking for some security help, his blog over at noquarter.typepad.com. Larry Johnson, hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I prefer to be with you in person, but over the phone will do.
Yeah, it was great meeting you in Washington, D.C. last week. Nice to put a face to the name and the voice and everything else. Larry, in the Guardian today, the UK newspaper, There's this article by Simon Tisdall. U.S. officials in Baghdad and Washington are expecting to unveil a secret intelligence dossier this week detailing evidence of Iran's alleged complicity in attacks on American troops in Iraq. The move uncomfortably echoing Downing Street's dossier debacle in the run-up to the 2003 Iraq invasion is one more sign that the Bush administration is building a case for war. And then it goes on through that. And in one of the comments that's attached to this, a guy who's apparently in the intelligence service and kind of posting anonymously says, rumor is the attack date is February 24th. The president gave the order to attack when he dispatched the second battle carrier group in mid-December, making a total of three battle groups in the Gulf. One group is always in rotation and in place based in the Gulf escorting tankers since 91. Admiral Fallon, the new head of CENTCOM, is in charge. His specialty is in planning air-sea warfare. Sort of like the Israeli Air Force General Dan Hallowitz, same level of competency, likes detail but doesn't see the big picture, major flaw. With all the provocations we have placed on Iran the last 4 weeks, they will attack first. Best hunch, lighting up the Straits of Hormuz. Admiral Fallon expects this, but hey, with all that ship traffic in the Gulf, something gets hit. You know, this is spooks talking to spooks, isn't it?
They're playing with fire right now.
Yeah.
And it is clear to me that the Bush administration has launched, at a minimum, a psychological operations campaign to try to provoke Iran into taking some action that will provide a casus belli for the United States to retaliate. And, you know, I've had some arguments with friends in the military and in the intelligence community on whether or not there has actually been approval signed off through the JCS level to go along with actually, you know, what's called an execute order, issuing an order that would allow the military to conduct operations. I don't think it's gotten there yet, but it certainly looks like it's heading in that direction.
But it wouldn't even need to be there if we were attacked first.
Well, you still at the end of the day, even if we are attacked by Iran, there's a process that the U.S. military goes through in activating, alerting forces and dispatching them out to carry out missions. And at the end of the day, the final stamp is something called an execute order,
mm-hmm.
where they're given, you know, the details of who's going to do what, who is the supported commander, in other words, which commander can call upon all resources to come to his aid and to
sure.
Do
but
he
if
wants
but
to
if
do.
But if the goal is not to set up and carry out an unprovoked attack, which may require, you know, months of advanced planning and people signing off on things, but rather to provoke an attack so that you can then have a response, then that execute order could presumably be done in a matter of minutes or hours rather than days.
It still has to go through the bureaucracy, but you're right. It can get out there quicker. I mean, you know, I had firsthand experience watching this when I was at CIA, and they were trying to provoke. We spent a year trying to get Manuel Noriega
mm-hmm.
to react to a variety of provocations, and he steered away from them.
Yeah.
So far, it looks like Iran is, you know, I think, smartly trying to do the same thing. I mean, I don't want to pretend that, you know, Iran is somehow, you know, a great place to be, but I think this is just so dangerous to try to open up another military front when we are really in very serious shape tactically and strategically inside Iraq.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that Ahmadinejad is going down in flames politically inside Iran right now. He got heckled right off the stage at Iranian University a couple of days ago.
Well, one of my good CIA buddies, we were exchanging emails this morning, and he said, you know, he couldn't come up with any explanation why George Bush would go out in public and say, we're going to go out and kill, capture Iranians operating in Iraq. I mean, if you really have that evidence, the way you do it as an intelligence officer is you go out and do it behind the scenes. The
yeah.
Iranians will get the message.
Sure.
But you don't have to go out and do it in public and force a confrontation.
Well, then why would he?
And
before you answer that, do you think that there's a connection between the five Iranians who were taken at, I forget the name of the city, up north near Karbala, and the five Americans who were murdered, and now Bush is saying it was Iranians who did it. Is this tit for tat?
Well, it could be. I mean, that is when it happened, and I spoke with a couple of different people knowledgeable about it, we all just said, hey, could this have been an Iranian op, simply because it was so well carried out and so sophisticated. But there is no evidence out there yet to support that. But
Could it have been a false flag operation?
Yeah,
could it have been our guys doing it to our guys?
I doubt that, because it's just, you know,
That's really pushing the envelope.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's a Hollywood fantasy, and, you know, I work with the special operations folks. You know, I know what they're capable of, and that just is not even in their, you know, index.
But this is the administration that actually seriously suggested painting a plane with UN colors and shooting it down, you know, to be able to...
Yeah, no, I think at this point they have no basis to ask people to accept them, trust their word, or trust them. They have no credibility. There's zero credibility left with this administration.
So back to the question, why is Bush then strutting around saying we're going to kill any Iranians when we find them at the same time that Maliki is cooperating with the Iranians and asking them for help in rebuilding his country?
Credible explanation I can come up with is the guy is just committed to his cowboy mentality.
Seriously.
It is not... You know, there's no thought there. It is entirely emotional. It's the frat boy in him. Because, you know, this is, they're treading into waters that, you know, once you get into them, there's no getting out easily. And
so this is sort of the equivalent of, you know, bring them on. This is Bush being impulsive?
Not impulsive. I think it is, He operates at a very general level without thinking through the consequences of if we go down this road, then what? It's extremely curious because what we've seen is a deliberate shift in the propaganda being put out by the administration about who's responsible for the violence in Iraq. It's increasingly over the last 2 weeks been focused on it's Iran.
Right.
Whereas before it was focused on, no, it's Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Sunnis.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And the reality is most of the violence in Iraq is neither Al-Qaeda nor Iranian. It is from Iraqi insurgent groups that want the United States out. That's where the violence is coming from. So they keep, you know, making it up as they go along.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I've noticed is that the media in the United States is just buying this hook, line, and sinker all over again. I mean, I heard on three different networks this morning, I heard news reports about how the U.S. is looking into Iranian involvement in the insurgent activity, you know, and it's like, and nobody's saying, and by the way, you know, there's Jordanian agents in there, and there's Saudi agents in there, and they're helping the Sunnis, and maybe it has something to do with the fact that the locals don't want us. I mean, nothing.
But
it's uncritical.
You saw it even yesterday with that news out of Britain that supposedly they disrupted a plot to behead a British soldier and show it on the Internet. Gee, what was going on the day before in Britain? Oh, Tony Blair's financial guy got arrested.
Mm.
You know, these folks have, you know, unfortunately they have a track record where they use terrorist threat information and they use scare tactics to try to drive public support. And public can't help themselves. They think, oh, surely the government knows better than we do.
Yeah.
But now we've had the experience. We know, in fact, they don't.
Yeah. So Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com. Larry, if we provoke an attack or if we simply attack Iran from the Gulf, you know, presumably an aerial attack from one of the aircraft carrier groups, Iran, if we do that, In February or March, when would you expect it to happen? And B, do you think that the Soviets or the Chinese would get involved in this thing? I mean, how's this going to play out?
Well, I think there is a strong likelihood that the Soviets and the Chinese would intervene in the same way that we did with the British when they went into the Suez Canal and took the Suez Canal over in the 50s. But I think what we ought to be more concerned about is Iran's capability to retaliate both against the Saudi Arabian oil fields to shut those down and to close down the Gulf temporarily. The tactics employed by Hezbollah in southern Lebanon against the Israeli warship that took a missile in the side and almost sunk it, that was an Iranian missile manufactured in Iran and sent to Hezbollah for their use. So in addition, the Iranians have, you know, they've paid attention. We've been warning loud and clear that we're going to attack them. So what they're doing, they're prepared.
And we're putting all our targets right in this little bathtub with this little tiny exit point.
Very dangerous.
And they've got all these Silkworm missiles or whatever they are. Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com, his blog. Check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me.
Good talking with you.
Bye-bye.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news.
Cry, you say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie,
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Interesting. Randy White here hanging out in the studio with David and I, and he's like, what happened with the U.S. and England and the Suez Canal that Larry was talking about? And I'm like, you know, I'm not sure. I wasn't all that old. That was 1957. I don't know. I thought it was, you know, diplomatic, but turns out it was. And basically what happened was the Brits and the French and somebody else seized the, and Israel, Great Britain, France, and Israel, seized the, Britain, theoretically, seized the Suez Canal, tried to get it back from Egypt. Because Nasser had nationalized it, and there were French stockholders in the Suez Canal Company, and although Nasser promised compensation to the company for its loss, Britain, France, and Israel began plotting to take back the canal and overthrow Nasser as well. And when attempts to reach an agreement with Egypt on a new form of international control for the canal failed, Israel accused Egypt of planning an attack and sent the Israeli army across the Sinai Peninsula toward the canal. Britain, France, and Israel had united in secret, something they denied publicly for many years, and made arrangements for Israel to make the initial invasion of Egypt and capture one side of the Suez Canal. And so what happens to the U.S. under Eisenhower, January 1957, says, no, you can't do this. And we went into the U.N. and January 1957, Eisenhower asked Congress for authorization to use military force if requested by any Middle Eastern nation to check aggression, and to set aside $200 million to help Middle Eastern countries. This came to be known as the Eisenhower Doctrine. He was basically saying, no, you know, we defend Egypt's right to determine their own future. And so France, England, and Israel backed down, and the Suez Canal remained in the hands of Egypt. So, in other words, what Larry Johnson was suggesting is if we attack Iran, that Russia and China will then diplomatically tell us, hands off, buddy, and back it up with a threat of military force. Not to put words in Larry's mouth, but that's interesting. Prez in San Francisco, California. Hey, Prez, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better.
Perhaps we should give Iraq $200 million to defend themselves against us.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Not to take what's a joke and make it serious, if we were to take a third of the money that we're spending or a fifth of the money that we're spending in Iraq right now and simply give it to the Iraqi government and say, you guys rebuild your own country with your own companies. We know that you know how to build Iraq because you already did it once before. You've done it multiple times. It's a 7,000-year-old civilization. And they had their own companies, like we did with the Marshall Plan in Europe in the late 40s, early 50s. They had their own companies rebuilding their country and rebuilding their cement industry and rebuilding their construction industry. Not only would they put their country back together faster, they would employ a whole lot of people really fast. You'd get all these so-called terrorists off the street, the insurgency. I mean, you would end all the problems, or most of the problems, bang, just like that.
I agree. One of the most literate societies with the most degreed people in the world.
It was. It was. Now they've got, now 2 million people have fled the country. Basically the educated middle class, and you've got another 200,000-300,000 internal refugees. One of the highest numbers in the world right now.
Right. And I'm glad Larry Johnson brought up the point that it's the Iraqis that are fighting this, and all the people in Jordan and Syria are asking for aid now to help the expatriates.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk quickly. I want to add education to your comments along with transportation.
It always has been. I mean, that's why we have free public education.
Exactly.
But I think it should be extended through college. I think
they're trying to make that two-tier as well, you know.
Public education. Yeah, the whole voucher thing.
You know, one part of the Cheney memo that I think some people might have missed, Randy Rhodes is bringing it up last night, God bless her, the word incompetent that Cheney put in there.
Right.
In other words, referring to the attempt, the smear attempt was done incompetently, not secretively enough. That should be really important, that word right there. In other words, they blew it.
Yeah.
And
so these guys are covering up.
Pay for that.
They're covering up their own cover-up.
Exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, and also, remember, somebody needs to dredge up what Bush Sr. said about outing a CIA agent. I'm sure you know what he said. It was one of the highest acts of treason committable.
Yes.
Yes, that needs to be brought up.
Yeah.
And also,
repeatedly. Yeah.
When the Bush Jr., let's call him Jr. because that's what he is in every way, the admission of wiretapping people, that's enough right there. That's all we really need.
Yeah, at that point, somebody, at that point, you know, if we had, unfortunately, the administration has to investigate itself because the Department of Justice is under Bush. But at that point, the Attorney General should have appointed a special prosecutor and said, hey, wait a minute, it sounds to me like a federal official just admitted to violating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which says that if a federal official violates this act, they face 2 years in prison and a rather massive fine. Prez, thanks a lot for the call. Good point. And it may yet happen. I don't think it's going to come from Gonzalez, but I think it will come from Congress. I really do. There is so much stuff, and you've got enough Democrats who are sufficiently angry. I don't think they're going to let this stuff stand. And they aren't. You're seeing John Conyers begin right now. 27 minutes past the hour.
I'm an independent trucker. From a guy that's overloaded, owner-operator, just tearing up the two-lane road.
Yeah. And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 34 minutes past the hour. And let's take a quick look at what's going on with the ongoing occupation, U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And they're alive in the balance.
Security developments in Iraq as of 1,000 hours Greenwich Mean Time on Thursday, compiled by Reuters. Dateline Baqaba, gunmen broke into the physical education college in Dalia and killed the dean, Wahalan Hamed al-Rubai, in Baqaba. In Baghdad, 6 people were killed and 12 wounded when a suicide bomber blew himself up in a minibus in the central Baghdad district of Qarada. In Baghdad, 10 mortar rounds landed on the Ahmadiyya district of Baghdad, killing one person and wounding 9. In Baghdad, the U.S. military said its troops killed one foreign terrorist facilitator and detained 29 suspected insurgents. In Baghdad, the U.S. military said its troops killed 4 insurgents who appear to be planting a roadside bomb. In Diwania, a gunman killed 2 policemen in that southern city on Wednesday and wounded a 3rd. In Mosul, police found the bodies of 3 people, including 2 students. In Mosul, a mortar round killed 2 civilians when they landed in a residential area. And in Anbar province, a U.S. soldier died from wounds sustained in an attack on Tuesday in that insurgent stronghold. Meanwhile, this story comes to us via Bob Geiger, geiger.blogspot.com. Jonathan Schultz was a United States Marine. He died earlier this month at the age of 25, not in Iraq, but back home in Minnesota. Schultz had a harrowing time in Iraq, spending time in the heated battles of Ramadi in April 2004. While he was there, 35 Marines in his unit were killed, including 17 of them in just 48 hours of combat. According to Minnesota press reports, Schultz went to the Veterans Administration Center in Minneapolis on December 14, 2006, met with a psychiatrist and was told that he could only be admitted for treatment 4 months later in March. He was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. On January 11, 2007, accompanied by his parents, he went to the VA hospital in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and told people at that facility that he was thinking of killing himself. They told Schultz that they could not admit him as a patient and sent him home. The next day, January 12th, Schultz called the VA reiterating that he was feeling suicidal. He was told that he was number 26 on the waiting list. A man who had risked his life in Iraq and done everything that was asked of him by the United States government was told by that same government that his sacrifice would be repaid by being 26th on the list of veterans similarly crying out for help. On January 16th, Schultz called his family and told him that he was going to do it. He was going to kill himself. His family called the local police, who raced to his house, kicked in the door, and found him hanging from an electrical cord. Attempts to resuscitate him were unsuccessful. Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat in North Dakota, brought this story to the floor of the Senate and read it into the record on Monday. He said, "This story is nearly unbelievable to me." The newspaper description of the flag-draped coffin of this young Marine who earned two Purple Hearts fighting for his country in Iraq contains a sad, sad story of a young Marine who should have gotten medical help for serious psychological problems that were the result of his wartime experience. He leaves behind, Jonathan Schultz leaves behind a fiancé, six-month-old daughter, and a fiancé who is pregnant with another child. Also, just some quick news. Center for American Progress reports over at thinkprogress.org. A study released by the Congressional Budget Office shows that the real troop increase associated with Bush's escalation policy could be as high as 48,000, more than double the 21,500 soldiers Bush has claimed. As Defense Tech notes, extra forces are expected because the combat units sent into Iraq need to be backed up by support troops, including personnel to staff headquarters, service military police, provide communications, contracting, engineering, intelligence, medical, and other services. Additionally, the cost of the escalation could be as much as five times higher than the White House estimates. According to the study, the cost for the surge could be dramatically different than what the president has said. The White House estimated it would cost $5.6 billion. The Congressional Budget Office now believes the cost would range from $9 to $13 billion for a four-month deployment and from $20 to $27 billion for a one-year deployment. And finally, George Bush has admitted now that he lied to Americans about Iraq in the lead-up to the midterm elections. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, President Bush published today, President Bush acknowledged that as early as September, October of 2006, he realized a major change was needed in Iraq. Wall Street Journal, question. Was there a moment in the war when you said that we have to make a major change in the way things are going in Iraq? We're doing things in Iraq? George W. Bush, yes, there was. Wall Street Journal, when was that? George W. Bush, September, October. But as they note over at Think Progress, but even after Bush realized that a major change was needed in the weeks just prior to the midterm elections, he continued to knowingly mislead the American public and claim the U.S. was winning in Iraq and that the strategy was working. For example, on the 10th and 25th of October, he said, he was asked in a press conference, are we winning? Absolutely we're winning. We're winning and we will win unless we leave before the job is done and the crucial battle right now is Iraq. Later on that same day, he said, but I believe that the military strategy we have is working. That's what I believe. Now, admitting to the Wall Street Journal he was lying at the time. On November 1st, he said, the questioner, just to be clear, when the commanders on the ground tell the president in the larger picture we are stepping closer to chaos, he believes that can also be a picture of winning? Tony Snow, yes. Bush, we've got a lot going for us. We've got a strategy that helps us achieve victory. And we've got a military that is the finest military any country has ever assembled. November 3rd, 06. Previously, of course, Bush acknowledged lying about Rumsfeld. He had decided that he was going to replace Rumsfeld before the elections. And after the elections, it was an amazing moment when he's standing there in front of the White House press corps. And they said, why didn't you tell us at the time, and he said, there was an election coming up. I didn't want you to know. But you told us that everything was fine. Well, I was lying to you. There was an election coming up. He didn't literally say I was lying to you, but they all got it. There was this moment of just stoned silence when he realized that he had admitted that he was lying. And then he, tries to dissemble about it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Steve in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? I was listening with interest to your telling of the history of the Suez Canal business and stuff, and it's really interesting that the United States, Britain, France, and Israel have cooperated on many of these things.
Well, actually, we were the non-cooperators.
Well, can I just finish my,
sure,
my point? Thank you. What I find most interesting about it is that of all those nations, the only one that has to sit in the Middle East and have bombs lobbed across its border by Hezbollah and have bombs go off in its passenger buses is Israel.
Sure.
And I'm getting pretty sick of hearing people, I think they have it backward when they say that the United States is fighting a war in Iraq.
for Israel when I think that Israel has had to do the dirty work for the West in a lot of ways.
Well, in fact, I would submit to you, Steve, that our invasion of Iraq has made Israel far less secure. We have done a tremendous amount of damage to Israel and Israel's interests by invading Iraq. And it's absolutely the worst thing that could have been done. Michael in Marina Del Rey, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, with Scooter Libby in the news and mention of uranium, yellow cake, and also the lies running up to this proposed invasion, I really haven't heard on the air much any reference to the theft in Rome from the Niger embassy of the materials that were used then to create the forged yellow cake uranium document.
That was apparently done by Berlusconi's Italian intelligence folks on behalf of Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush.
I don't think it's much of a reach, even though the documents were first presented in Italy. I don't think it's much of a reach at all to believe that those documents originated in the White House. I don't think this is like pure theory. And then went to Italy where he couldn't.
Here's what makes me think that they didn't, because when the British looked at them, they immediately knew that they were forgeries because they were apparently signed by by people who were already dead. And
right.
I would think that the White House's intelligence would be good enough to have known that, unless they didn't care if everybody knew that they were forgeries.
Well, and I think they
now we're into layers.
They wanted those forgeries so much they didn't care that they'd been discredited by the French, by the Germans.
Regardless of where they originated, Michael, the bottom line is that they knew that they were forgeries by the time Bush started talking about them in public. He knew that he was lying.
Agreed.
And now we know that he knew that he was lying and that he tried to punish the truth teller, Joe Wilson, and then he tried to punish the guys who pointed out that he was trying to punish the truth teller, and then he tried to protect the guys who were punishing the truth. You know, the whole sordid thing is coming unraveled in the Scooter Libby trial, and I'm just astounded that more Americans aren't just, you know, that this isn't being watched like the Watergate hearings were, that Americans aren't just, you know, holy cow, sitting there with their mouths open, and that it's not being covered 24/7 by all the networks on TV. I mean, it really should be. This should be, you know, CBS, NBC, ABC, they should be there at the Scooter Libby trial with their cameras, or if they can't, with their court reporters going, he said, what? What happened? You know, this is a big deal. 45 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. It ain't happening. Skipper Blue, by the way, in the chat room, which you can get to at tomhartman.com. Just click chat room up at the top of the page there. Take you right in there. Skipper Blue says, Tom, please give out the numbers for Patty Murray. There is, I'm assuming, Senator Patty Murray of Washington State. There is a virtual march in tribute of Molly Ivins going on today. And with or without the virtual march in tribute to Molly Ivins, the telephone number for all members of the House and Senate there is the direct number is 202-225-3121. And you can also call toll-free at 866-220-0044. Art in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Art, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Thank you. I got a couple of points. I'll try to make them quickly.
Thank you.
A couple of hours ago, you mentioned these 1,000 signing statements that George Bush has signed. And when he says he's the decider, he's really underestimating it, because if you're right, he's the emperor.
Yes.
And I suggest that if the Congress knew about these signing statements and the power that they gave the president, and if they did nothing, they fall into two categories. One of which is that they are stupid beyond words, which I don't discount. Secondly, if they knew the power they were giving him, knew that it was unconstitutional, then they are now unindicted co-conspirators.
Yeah.
And what could be done about it? And I don't know.
This needs to be adjudicated. The signing statements go back a long way. I mean, the presidents have been attaching signing statements for apparently over 100 years, occasionally to pieces of legislation. But most of them have been sort of on the order of, you know, jolly good, and I think this is a great idea and marvelous, and we'll do our best, or, you know, that kind of thing. It was Sam Alito, as an attorney in the Reagan administration, who came up with the idea that a signing statement could be used to actually change the meaning of legislation as it affects the executive branch. And he suggested that, and Reagan began the practice of attaching signing statements that actually changed the meaning of legislation. Bush Sr. apparently did this on a very limited basis. Reagan did it on a very limited basis. Clinton apparently did it. I don't know. You know, I'm still looking into all the details on this. And then George W. Bush came along and turned it into an art form. It really amped it up. So this is a big issue that really needs to go before the Supreme Court.
And the second point, try to make this as brief as possible.
Sure.
That I would suggest that if Senator Harry Reid and the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, were to really be concerned about George Bush simply catapulting us into a war with Iran, that they go to the president and they go and they at the same time schedule a news conference to say what they've said, and they say to the president, if you insist on going to war without the constitutional authority to do so, and you don't have it, what we're going to do is to suggest an immediate impeachment because you're violating the Constitution and you're doing it clearly.
Yeah,
and do this not only to the president, but do it publicly so that the public will realize that the Congress is not simply standing idly by and is not willing to see more American lives by the thousands lost.
Yeah, I think that might be a good political strategy, Art. I'm uncertain about that. The threat of impeachment without a specific crime is virtually impossible. I mean, you've got to have a hook to hang that hat on, number one. So that's why the investigations. And number two, the president does have the power to respond to an attack on the United States without congressional authority within a 90-day window. And, then Congress has to declare war. So if he can provoke an attack against us, he'll have a rationale. And that's the tough one. And that's what I think he's trying to do. I think he's trying to set this thing up so he's not even going to need a congressional resolution. But we'll see. Art, thank you for the call and for raising these issues. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Thomas, maybe talk about something a little less important, but I wanted to comment on the Joe Biden remarks.
Yeah, about Barack Obama, you mean?
Yeah, well, here's the thing that I don't get, you know, and I think we're in such a politically correct world now. Actually, everything Biden said at first was very complimentary. Now, I think all he was trying to say is, past black candidates notwithstanding, Barack Obama probably stands above them for various reasons. Now, of course, he did criticize Senator Obama, Senator Clinton, and Senator Edwards, and was quite uncomplimentary towards them about their beliefs and whatever policies, ideas on Iraq, and that didn't seem to get much play. And of course, I think the right-wing media loves this because, you know, they can play up the effect of Democrats attacking one another. But of course, they always have to play that race card, I think, to try and distance black voters from Democrats by saying, oh, these Democrats are racist, you know, don't go out and vote for them, don't you think?
So you're suggesting that the media is making more of Biden's comments than are actually there.
I think as far as the racial aspect, why in the world did Joe Biden have to apologize to Barack Obama for speaking nicely about him? And that's ridiculous.
Yeah. I am somewhat remiss here. I didn't actually hear the comment. I know everybody was talking about it yesterday on the news and everything, but
oh, yeah.
I had a very, very busy afternoon yesterday, and I didn't hear the comment.
As I said, it's relatively unimportant given all the other things going on, but I just thought I'd put my two cents in.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Rick.
Good to
hear from you. Always good to hear from you.
Bye.
Keith in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Keith, what's up?
A question, Tom, that I have that kind of goes back to the movie Dr. Strangelove.
Yes, sir.
And I have no doubt that Bush will manage to provoke Iraq or legally or illegally or whatever. But what happens, say, we drop a nuclear bomb or two on Iraq and then Israel drops one on Tehran?
Keith, it would be a mess of unimaginable proportions, and that's why we need to do everything we can to stop it from happening. Coming up tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders. Thanks for the call. Coming up tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. He'll be taking your calls as he does every Friday at noon. Conservative John Berlow in our second program is going to be here trashing Consumer Reports magazine. That should be interesting. And we're going to be writing my book, Cracking the Code, on the air. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.